Mark Steiner. As I told you earlier, we're about to have a conversation with Jerry Mander about his latest book, The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws in an Obsolete System. And Jerry, welcome back to the show. It's been on hiatus of at least a dozen years, or maybe 10 years, but welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be back.
And my colleague and friend in San Francisco at KALW, Rosa Aguilar, is a huge fan of this book, and I understand she did a wonderful interview with you sometime earlier.
Yeah. It was really, really good. I enjoyed it greatly.
She's an interesting comer in the world of public radio, I think. But your book. Mm-hmm. Let's just begin. This is, you know, people don't use this word, as you write in the beginning of the book, capitalism, very much. It's a word that people are afraid to even utter, as if it's some blasphemous word that will get you in trouble if you say the words. Mm. You know, you talk in the book about Bill Moyers quoting from Socrates, if you're going to remember a thing, you must first name it, though he didn't name capitalism.
He called it plutocracy. Well, that's okay. But he gave it a name, I believe.
He did give it a name. I think what you wrote, plutonomy?
Yes. I think he said plutonomy.
Plutonomy is what you wrote.
I can't remember.
But then you also quote in this early part Emmanuel Wallerstein about capitalism. And let's talk about that, what capitalism is and why we're afraid to utter the name and why it's important to utter this name.
Okay. Well, you know, the idea for the book really came in a conference that I was one of the co-sponsors of, saying, is capitalism soon over? That was the name of the conference. And it was a gathering in San Francisco of about 30 liberal economists, I would say. There were a few highly progressive ones and a few conservative ones, but very good economists who thought about a lot of things and whose books I knew. And we met for 3 days, and after about the third day, you know, people were kind of agreeing that capitalism's future, you know, capitalism had its day, and the future of capitalism was very, very dim because it was so contradictory to survival and various other needs of human society and nature that it probably couldn't survive, and that we needed to be talking about, you know, what we began to call economic succession. But a couple of people stood up in the room, a couple of these economists stood up in the room in the middle of this discussion and said that if we're going to talk about the end of capitalism, they have to leave the room. And these were people who I knew very, very well. I've read every word that they've written. They've written blistering critiques of capitalism, except they would never call it capitalism. They always called it free market fundamentalism or something else, you know,
mm-hmm.
and or corporate globalization or something like that. And we said, well, why are you doing that? Why are you leaving now? We all know where you stand. And they said, well, because if we name capitalism, we'll be ostracized and we'll be labeled communists and socialists. We'll be marginalized. I said, we're already marginalized. You know? You don't see us writing the main articles in the New York Times or on CBS television. So, but it's very important to identify the system by name, and that's, you know, then I quoted Moyers on that point, and also to reveal its structures, and it can't remain a taboo. We've really got to start talking about it by name, rather than just being vague about it, because that's the only way we can possibly coalesce agreement on the point in a wider group than the people who were in the room, you know. So that's when I kind of decided that, you know, I really got to write a book about this and try to pull together the ingredients of the system so that we can identify it when we see it and that we know what we're against. Right now, there are people who are trying to design new economic systems, but I sometimes wonder about what they're doing because they don't refer to anything. They're just sort of free floating in some cases, and it's far better to be able to say this will counter the problem of capitalism, you know, XYZ, and this is the answer to that, and so on. So I felt it was very important to reveal the structure of the system and to not be scared to name it by name.
So, and I think that's an important place to start. And I'm glad you started the book that way and this conversation this way. But I know the part of your thesis it has to do with that the part of the problem with capitalism is it's about the accumulation of wealth and resources and not sharing them, and that B, the Earth's resources are finite and we cannot grow our way out of the mess we are in.
Right.
That's an overview. We'll go back to specifics in a moment. But one thing you just said, I'd like to explore in that context, in the context of what you just described at the meeting that you took part in, is there any sense at all that the capitalism is really in imminent danger, given A, the power of capitalist states, whether they be China, the United States, or anybody else around the globe, and B, that with global warming and all the natural resources being unveiled throughout the Arctic and the Amazon basin now being flooded because they can get more, will be flooding it to get more resources and the taming of West Africa for the same. Are they really at the brink? Is the system really at the brink? Or is it just taking a last gasp that could last a very long time?
Well, I don't know. The book makes the case that we've got to get organized and start speaking about it as unsustainable. That is to say, there is no future for capitalism in the long run because we're running out of resources, and there are many other points in the book about why it can't possibly work in the long run. And economic growth, which is one of the basic things that capitalism built on, is constant economic growth and expansion of individual wealth by the people in control of the system, is running out of juice because we're running out of resources and we're running out of new investment opportunities, and you can't just keep destroying things and rebuilding them forever. So the future is grim. I mean, it's impossible for me to say how long that system can survive, but it's also prudent for all of us to begin to think of, okay, well, what is it about the system that makes it so impossible to survive, and how do we construct economic reality in a different way so that we face the fact of the diminishing resources and we face the need to organize things in a different way and begin to speak about that. Now, that's a long-haul political evolution that's required, and at the moment, it seems extremely impractical because the people who run capitalism are the people who run the system. You know, in the book, I go through, you know, seven main points. One of which is that the capitalist system, which has to keep growing, also needs to control the governing processes of the systems that it's in, so that whatever is left can get capitalized, can get privatized and capitalized, and they can make more money on as long as it lasts. You know, so that's why all, you know, water is even being privatized now, and agricultural land around the world is being bought up and used as a commodity and so on. It's turned into, you know, a investment issue rather than a food issue, and they're on their last legs of looking for new investments and resources, and it can't go on forever. But meanwhile, they're in charge, and so, you know, we see it in the presidential campaign where you know, the billionaires, a handful of billionaires, are really controlling the campaigns of both candidates. And it's very difficult to see how either of them steps out of those parameters if they're elected. I mean, Obama's obviously a little bit more to the left than Romney, but basically he can't do things that defy big oil in the long run. He can't do things that defy giant automobile companies or giant investment companies and so on. He's trapped. So it's very, very hard to see how a positive evolution will take place, but it's very important that we start talking about it because the only question is whether that we can achieve something different in a step-by-step democratic political process or whether things are going to collapse and we'll be facing apocalypse of one kind or another. So,
as many see, like a dystopian future in front of us.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's the realistic There's a chance that that's what's going to happen, and we want to avoid that, of course. Nobody wants
right.
to go that way, except some people are so dedicated to the idea of continuing their growth no matter what that they're sort of not thinking about the future. And you mentioned Wallerstein. I love his definition of capitalism,
yes.
which I'll just repeat briefly. It's a beauty because I think it captures the current capitalism better than Marx ever did. And that is capitalism, he defines basically as wealth, seeking more wealth in order to be in a better position to seek more wealth, in order to be a better position to seek more wealth, in order to be a better position to seek more wealth ad infinitum.
You know, right.
That's it. That's what's happening now. The wealthiest classes are basically just trying to get wealthier, and they do whatever is necessary to do that, and that's what contains the rest of us.
One of the powers of it all, I think you write about so eloquently in the middle of your book, and it harkens back to me to your book on four arguments against television that you wrote. You know, because I think one thing you talk about in the book is it's as if, I think I have this right, it's as if capitalism occupies a virtually permanent existence like a religion, a gift of God, infallible. And you write about living inside media and kind of the power because of advertising and the media itself, what the effects of capitalism are on our consciousness, whether it's on the for want of a better term at the moment, the 99% or even the schizophrenic world of the 1%. But that's in some ways the powerful hold that it has on us all is through that.
Indeed, you know, there are not many public radio stations anymore to express that kind of point of view. We have some, but they're struggling to survive and have to go through all these fundraising things all the time. I presume even you have
yes,
to do that.
Absolutely.
And but you know, the figures on the control of media in the world are totally shocking. It's also one of the arguments, one of the 7 points of the book, is that capitalism requires the control of consciousness, and by that, by conscience, I mean what people know, what they think, how they view the world, how they view themselves, and they do that largely through control of media. And right now, the figures, at least as of about a year ago, are that 7 corporations control about 70% of global media, and that's all media. That's radio and television and films and billboards and increasingly the internet as well, and that so that the great huge majority of the people in the world are sitting in front of their television sets, for example, night after night, you know, on an average of over 4 hours per day, and they're sitting there in a passive manner, gathering in these images, and the images are sent by subsidiaries, usually, of these 7 giant corporations, those corporations only have an interest in people viewing the world in a certain kind of way, which is that commodity culture is what matters, and that, you know, your personal economic advancement is the most important thing, and that what will make you happy is buying more cars or buying more perfume or, you know, whatever is convenient for them to be advertising. And that's how life is viewed increasingly by the whole world. And so this person is advertising this, and that person is advertising that, but they're all telling you to go buy something, and that's what satisfaction is going to come from, and that's what life is about. And that's because that's what life is about for them. That's how they keep their profits coming in, and that's the way the world is arranged right now. So you know, people thought it would be different when the internet came along, and I personally thought so too, because that's an interactive, much more interactive medium.
Mm-hmm.
You do get to, you know, input it and you know, use it back and forth, but the figures are kind of shocking, because the people are watching the same amount of television now as they did 15 or 20 years ago. It hasn't changed changed by a few degrees, but mostly they're watching at the same rate that they did before. All the internet has done is add time to their experience of living the world through technology and through commercialism. And there is a lot of interaction, but there's also a hell of a lot of advertising now on the internet, and a hell of a lot of commercial orientation,
yes.
and also a lot of control of media content and programming by the same interests that that control all the other mass media. So it hasn't really improved the situation. I mean, I would argue that it makes it worse, because it makes people, instead of 4.5 hours per day, maybe they're spending 10 hours per day now living their life through technology and through a medium, and dealing in, you know, what was once called processed world, you know, a world that is reinterpreted for them, and that is not a direct experience for them. So that's very, very dangerous, I think. And you're getting, and not only that, but it's happening globally. So you're getting basically a global unification of consciousness, where everybody sees the world in the same way, or roughly speaking the same way. It's not exactly true, but of everywhere. But as a generality, everyone is seeing the world in roughly the same way. And that only enhances and supports the control of the handful of corporations that are speaking through it.
So, I mean, you had a piece, a section of your book on, are we immune to it? And none of us were immune to this. I mean, it affects all of us. You have this great example of a province in India, Ladakh, that was lived happily and sustainably and more of an indigenous life, but it became inundated, and overnight things changed. And that's what happens to all of us.
That's correct, yeah. And the power of these images, you know, I used to be in the advertising business for quite a long time, for a decade, and in commercial advertising. Then I went into nonprofit advertising, where I worked for nonprofit organizations and environmental groups, etc. But I wasn't long in the advertising business before I realized these images have power. These images have power. And my partner in business in those days was a guy named Howard Gossage, very famous advertising man, very brilliant guy who hated advertising. He felt he got caught in it very early, and you know, he made a living out of it. But he tried always very hard to be a critic of it at the same time. And he said one time, you know, it's really a dirty little secret of the advertising industry that images that go in don't come out. In other words, once people get implanted with imagery from advertising, you can't let it go. I mean, I like to ask people, to test this out.
Mm-hmm.
I ask them, if I say the word gecko, what comes into their head? What comes into your head?
Well, when you say gecko, the first thing that comes to my head is that stupid commercial about
insurance.
Gecko, right.
If I say a chihuahua, what comes into your head?
Chihuahua?
Yeah.
Oh, I know that commercial. I don't watch enough TV. That's my problem.
Taco Bell,
that's it, right. Taco Bell, right.
Gossage used to use a Jolly Green Giant, you know, and what comes into people. But that's maybe a little out of date now. But anyway, the point is, when I've talked to audiences and raised those points, and you know, people are just astonished to realize they're carrying that image around in their heads. You know, they didn't even know that. I said, you can't get rid of it either. There's no way you can erase that. Once it's in, it's in. So this is an extremely powerful system.
Yep.
If it was used maybe in a better way, it could, or less of it anyway, it could have value, I think, in terms of informing people about life and the world. But if it's in control, if it's totally in the hands of a giant group of commercial interests, all of whom have the same idea about how life should be lived. I mean, one is selling cars and the other one's selling oil. They all agree, basically, that life is to be lived in terms of commodity consumption. Then we're all engaged in that, and we all get these images going in our brains hour after hour after hour after hour, and then walk around with those images without even knowing that we're walking around with them. This is a serious, brainwashing system, basically, of massive global proportions, and it's being used to prop up a system which is destroying the planet. So there you have it.
and you know that world so well. And I worked in that world for only 3 years.
Uh-huh.
And I ran from it after 3 years. And I
good for you.
I enjoyed myself. It was creative and fun. You have a blast.
It was totally fun. It's completely it was the funnest job I ever had.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. You stay in great hotels.
Also, mine
eat
was
great
in
food.
The 60s, you know.
Yeah.
And so it was really fun.
Right. But I just couldn't do it anymore. I just couldn't sell. I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But let me take a step backwards for a minute. I want you to jump into this consciousness question because of what you said earlier, and I'll come back to that a little bit. But I do want to take a step backwards, just in terms of defining what you did early in the book and then again later in the book about how the kind of modern capitalism of post-World War II took hold, whether you're talking about in the book when you talked about how after World War II, General Electric had no war to fight, so their job was to build the nuclear industry in Japan, or the role that Robert McNamara and the World Bank played in the 60s in kind of dominating the developing world. Talk a bit about that, because to me those two segments really went together in terms.
Well, I have two sections here about, well, one of them is about the, you know, permanent war, how capitalism really benefits from a war-oriented economy. And the point was that we got into the Depression in the 30s after the, you know, it's sort of a more extreme version of what's happened recently, the complete overexpression of the system in the 20s, and then all the bubbles broke, and then we got into the Depression. And basically, the only way we got out of the Depression was massive public spending by Roosevelt, and then war. And war is really what got us out of the Depression, because that put those factories to work, and manufacturing war equipment. And while the soldiers were overseas fighting the war, the women got jobs in the factories. And all of a sudden, these empty factories that had been empty during the Depression were now humming again, producing war equipment that was being used for our efforts. And then suddenly the war was over. And there was a little bit of a panic on the part of the powers that be in the United States, in the Truman administration after the war, because they saw the factories emptying out of workers again. The men were coming back looking for jobs. The women had to go back into the houses, you know, according to the standards of that period. And there was no point in manufacturing more armaments if the war was over. Of course, we did develop a Cold War very fast, so there was an argument that we should keep developing armaments. But then part of the Truman administration decided that, you know, war really was the answer. And you didn't actually have to fight the wars. You just had to be ready for the wars. Some wars, you might have to fight some little wars in order to make it all realistic. But the main thing was to sustain military production. So the United States, which had previously been a relatively minor military producer economically, started to grow the economic part of the industry, economic part of our capacity very, very much more rapidly. And corporations like General Electric, which had been the major war manufacturer, continued to be a war manufacturer, but also added nuclear energy, and the Truman administration kind of imposed that. But the main point is that Paul Nitze, who was then the head of the U.S. Security Council, and Truman agreed that there should be a new economic doctrine where military production is considered an economic strategy rather than just a war prevention strategy, and that military production had to be maintained at a very high level in order to, they said, protect us against, well, it was Russia first and then China, and then, you know, all these other wars. We have, what, three wars going, but we've always had a few little wars going, but mainly we're trying to ramp up against whatever enemy we can potentially find. I mean, they keep varying. There was Venezuela was, you know, considered a major new danger for a while. And now China, of course, the whole U.S. military thing is shifting over to the Pacific now to get ready for a big war with China. But it's not really the war so much. It's the preparation for the war that really is useful to the economy. And right now, you know, I think it's 47% of the U.S. discretionary economic spending is for war production. And the U.S. produces, the U.S. budget for war is bigger than all of the other countries in the world combined. And it has been a very important reason why U.S. economic power has spread itself around the world to such a great degree with military bases. I don't know what we have lately. It's about 1,000 military bases in foreign countries. We have about 500 in the Pacific alone. And very few other countries have any military bases in other places. And it's all to protect the world against some enemy or other that might be coming along. In this, but lately it's China. Recently it was Russia. And as well as some smaller countries. Well, we have Iran, of course, floating around as a big danger point that we focus on madly. So the focus on war production is a very, very much important part of capitalism. But I would say it's an antidote to economic failure. That if we didn't have military production at the level that it now is, you'd really see an economic collapse in this country. You know, you'd really see. I mean, the economic war production is what keeps this country propped up economically. You know, there's 15 giant corporations who get, I forget now the number I use in the book, but it's something like half the total military production goes to a few giant corporations, right. Lockheed Martin, General Electric, Boeing, Halliburton, you know, companies like that. And those companies are the job creators of our time. And that's what keeps the economy going. So you know, it's really a question, what, you know, would a capitalist economy even function if it wasn't for war production right now?
We're talking with Jerry Mander. His book is, his latest book is called The Capitalism Papers. And we'll take a very brief break and come right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're going to continue our conversation with Jerry Manners about his latest book, The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. His previous books have been things like Absence of the Sacred and Four Arguments Against Television. And Jerry joins us today. And Jerry, picking up where we left off, I think that there are a couple of things here I'd really like to go back to and explore in some depth, a little greater depth than we have. You make these arguments, literally make these arguments against capitalism and why it is a system that cannot sustain itself. And you do this throughout the book, but you begin it early on in the book where you lay out six structural defects of capitalism that I think would be important kind of to talk about a bit so people get a sense of why you argue this, that capitalism cannot work and why
right.
It's lived to its point of no end. From amorality, dependence on growth, propensity to war, which you talked about a bit, intrinsically inequitable, undermines democracy, and capitalism does not bring happiness. So talk just a minute about those things you think that we don't see all the time, that talk about why capitalism is a system that is antiquated and lived its day.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, probably the most dominant one that's begun to be talked about lately is its dependence on growth. You know, capitalism requires, as we mentioned earlier, the Wallerstein definition, I think that's very, very accurate. Capitalism requires never-ending expansion, and never-ending expansion mostly comes from never-ending use of increasingly scarce resources. So there's a dead end up ahead. Or Richard Heinberg, you know, wrote a book called The Party's Over, and I think that's a great title.
Yeah, I want to read that book. I see it, you referenced it in your book, and I've not read it, so I'm dying to read it, actually.
It's very good. And he points out how many resources, you know, we're hearing about climate change, and we're hearing about scarcity of cheap oil, but we're also completely running out of arable food-growing land. And that's making food a lot more expensive, and it's also changing the land into a commodity for global financial investors. In other words, they're buying up Africa right now at a very, very, very high rate. Another great person you might talk to is Anuradha Mittal from the Oakland Institute, who's done massive studies on this point, really, really good, how many giant corporations and financial institutions, you know, Goldman Sachs of the world, are buying up gigantic parts of Africa, kicking the people off the land, and just letting the land either grow, you know, commodities for the rich countries, or just let it go fallow, because as food gets more and more expensive and land gets scarcer, the value of the land goes up, and they just sell it. It becomes a trading commodity. And also resources, mineral resources, and biodiversity are all in great diminishing greatly right now, so that the whole base of the industrial economy is. Australia has already put out a warning notice saying that their economy, which is highly dependent upon minerals in the ground and adapting those minerals and constructing those minerals, is on its last legs, that they're running out of all kinds of key minerals, including things like coltan and rare earth materials that are all used in the by all the electronic company producers that are the basis of so much of the economy right now. So the demand for never-ending growth is on a finite planet where the limits are already clearly in view, is a real expression of the failure of the system and the impossibility for its survival. And the big money people, the billionaires, already know about this. They know that there's not as much profit to be made in what's called the real economy, that is to say, of manufacturing and services. And it's far better it's far more profitable to invest in derivatives and play that market, which doesn't do anything useful. That's the virtual economy, or else put their money into politicians. You know, just invest in senators. I think it costs about $250,000 now for a senator, and about $100,000 for a congressman, and I guess it's about $1 billion for a president. And just try to own those people and get them to make rules that benefit you in terms of taxes and so on. And that's where a lot of the money, more money, is going in that direction than it is toward economic growth. And so economic growth really is an impossibility, and so the system cannot survive just on those grounds all alone. It can't really survive. The second point that I think is equally important is that it's a system that operates strictly without morals. In the chapters, I say it's intrinsically amoral. And, you know, I don't know, you've seen the movie Avatar, probably.
Yes.
Haven't you?
Which you write about, right.
I write about that in the book because there's a great scene in that book, movie, which has not gotten noticed enough, I think, but it's just fabulous. And I didn't love the movie, but I really love this scene. And that's where a corporate spaceship is sent out to the planets to find planets that still have a lot of resources, because the planet Earth at that point is already running out of resources, and people are recognizing it's a situation like today. So this corporate spaceship goes out looking for resources and finds this distant planet, and it's filled with resources. The only problem is that there are indigenous people living on that planet. And so he sends down his military and says to the people, you got to move off your land. And the people say, no, we're not going to move off our land, you know, in typical indigenous fashion. They don't want to move somewhere else. They've been there for 4,000 years. So the military guy calls and says to the corporate guy, they don't want to leave. What should I do? Should I kill them? And then the film slows down. And you see the corporate guy going through this internal struggle. Well, should we kill these people or what? You know. And so he says to himself, well, you know, our shareholders really won't like it if we kill a lot of innocent people. But on the other hand, they'll like it even less if they have a really bad quarterly financial report. So yeah, go ahead, kill all those people. So that process of internal self-consideration, you might say, is what I call in the book corporate schizophrenia. I talk about that also in The Absence of the Sacred.
Right.
It's that human beings work in these corporations. These are people who are your neighbors. You're in church with them. Your children play together. These are perfectly live human beings who have feelings and concerns and spiritual values and et cetera. But they get inside the corporate structure, and the corporate structure has only one goal, growth and wealth creation. That's all. There's no such thing as moral consideration. In fact, corporations are legally required to show profits for their shareholders. The shareholders have to make profits, or they have to try to make profits. And if they do something that's instead, oh, well, we won't develop that mountaintop because it's, you know, bad for nature, then you all get fired, thrown out of work, you know. And it happens sometimes where decisions are made on moral or environmental grounds where the shareholders or board of directors say, you can't do that. We saw that. I also talk about the great case of the Union Carbide Corporation and the Exxon Valdez.
Right. Those, I was going to raise that just now, because those are real examples you used of people who actually had this empathy and then they switched.
Yeah. Both the Bhopal, you know, which killed a whole lot of people in India, the gas release in India, and then the Exxon Valdez, which had a ship crash off the coast of Alaska and destroyed all the beaches and wildlife and so on in that region. The presidents of both of those corporations got on national television shortly after. They said, we're so sorry. I feel so terrible. I'm going to devote the rest of my life to correcting this situation. So what they did was they were being human beings. They were really sorry. They were real people. And they said what they really felt. But 2 months later, they were back on national television saying, we're fighting these cases at in every court and every way possible, and no, it was not our fault, and this other corporation contributed to the problem, and the captain of the Exxon Valdez, he was drunk, and it was really his fault, and we can't be sued about that, and et cetera. You know? So what happens in the interim is that somebody calls these people and says, you can't go on national television and admit our problem and that you're going to fix everything and devote the rest of your life. You can't say that. Our stock just fell 400 points because you said that. And you've got to say how it wasn't our fault, and we're going to keep making profits and keep doing the same as we've always been doing, and we're going to fight these cases and win them, and your profits won't be... I mean, the point is that there are two different standards. You have two different standards. There's the human being, and then there's the corporate philosophy, the corporate structure, the corporate requirements for growth and profit. And the human being can have bad feelings, but he's got to act according to the rules of the system. And that's what I call this corporate schizophrenia. But it's all about the intrinsic lack of moral quality in corporations, that they don't make decisions based on that. They do public relations advertising saying that they do care, but they don't care. They can't care. They're not allowed to care. They're only allowed to care about profits. And it's a very, very, very rare corporation that will say anything different than that. Privately held corporations can. I mean, if there are three people who own I've been on the board of a corporation where there was only a few owners, and they did make some more moral decisions because there was only three people and they didn't have shareholders and boards of directors ruling over them saying that they can't do that. So if they're willing to take the economic hit, they can make that decision without any wider repercussions from stock markets and major billionaire investors and so on. So that's, you know, and small local there's a very important difference that I cite in the book between
in the very beginning, especially yeah,
we start off local that way. Capitalism, small market capitalism, and global capitalism, companies that are owned by the stock market investors. That's a huge difference. In fact, they shouldn't really be named the same thing. Small, you know, people who run the local bookstore, or the local market, or the local furniture store are just not in the same and serving the local community. They're not in the same business as Shell Oil or General Motors or, you know, Merrill Lynch or any of these giant financial institutions. It's a completely different thing. They really should have a different name. Small market business should not be considered in the same light And I have no problem at all with people making a little money and sending their kids to college and living a good life for themselves. That's not the problem. The big problem is giant global capitalism and national capitalism and capitalism, which is abstracted to a financial level.
And a couple of quick things in the last 50 minutes or so that we have. I mean, what you just described and what you describe in the book about the leaders of Exxon and Union Carbide and what we talked about earlier in terms of how the advertising and mass media can really control consciousness in many ways, and the idea this is the only kind of system that can possibly work on the planet Earth because it's been around us for so long and this is it.
Yeah. Right?
Every culture and society affects the consciousness of the human beings who live within it.
That's correct.
Right? But part of your argument, if you take it and tie some of it together, is that the consciousness that we've developed, whether as a corporate manager or as a worker in a factory or a farmer, whoever we might be, or a public radio host, you know, it's that it affects the way we think. It affects the way we view the world because that's the only lens we're allowed to see it through.
Well, it's hard to break away from that, too, because, you know, in the United States, I mean, another argument I did, I won't have time, obviously, to go into that, but is the corporate structure, it's a very specific kind of hierarchical structure in which power resides in a very small number of people at the top, and they get to decide the lives of everybody else. But, you know, the great majority of people in the world now are within corporate structure. And it's bizarre that nobody has really kind of noticed that or focused on it. You know, corporates in the United States, I don't know the exact figure, but my guess is about 70% of the population works one way or another for a corporation or is dependent upon corporate activity. And in the world, it's probably slightly less than that, but it's very, very high number. So the great majority of the world population is living within corporate structure, corporate form, corporate intentions, corporate values, and is a victim of corporate decisions without being able to affect it. And that is that's weird. And when you add up all these qualities, you know, insistence upon growth, no morality, domination of consciousness, domination of government, so on, we didn't even get to happiness. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, it's just like, can we talk about this? You know, do we really think this is really the right way to go? Is this really what we want for the world, for our children and grandchildren and so on? I don't think so.
And you write a great deal. I mean, you write about the whole idea of capitalism or happiness.
I do. The last chapter of the book is the last chapter of the 7 points. There's another chapter at the end about the future. I say, you know, the United States is the leading example in the world of laissez-faire capitalism, let's say unregulated capitalism. There's a little bit of regulation, but the right wing is doing everything they can to eliminate the last vestiges of it. But among all countries in the world, the United States is the least regulated form of capitalism. So this ought to be, if they were right about that being the right system for the world, this ought to be the happiest culture in the world. And yet these studies that have lately been done about self-assessments by people in different countries of whether they're happy or not, the United States is very, 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 very low on the list, in the lower half of people saying that they're happy, people who live in the... And the figures, you know, bear that out. It is the highest rate of divorce in the world, the highest rate of obesity in the world, the highest rate of maternal mortality, infant mortality, childhood poverty.
Incarceration,
armed robbery... And not a very high rate of home ownership. You know, the United States is based on the values of home ownership. Everybody's always talking about the middle class and home ownership. We're about halfway down the list of countries in terms of the ability for home ownership. We're about halfway down middle class.
Right.
You know, we have about 53% middle class in the United States, and Japan has 90%, and Sweden has 83%, and Germany has 79%. China is growing a giant middle class right now. So, and voter turnout is another great, good figure to talk about. You know, the United States has about 30% voter turnout in local elections, about 45% in the average congressional election, and about 55% in presidential elections. You know, that there are 23 countries in the world where the turnout is over 80% in national elections. So to have such a low voter turnout can only be a sign that people think that democracy is non-functional. I don't know what else it could mean. And that they are somehow really excluded from the ability to participate and be in a meaningful way. And that's another sign of the inadequacy and lack of confidence in the system right there.
I think that a couple of things towards the end of the book I think are important for us to kind of just lay out for a minute here. I think we can combine them somehow. Is that you talk about these four mega shifts, which I think are really important. You also talk about much of this is uncharted territory that we don't know yet. I mean, this is an argument I had, discussion I have with a lot of people, especially some of my more left-wing friends, which is we really do not know what comes next. We're not sure what it looks like. People know that this is not working. We're not sure what is.
Right. Well, that's absolutely right. And a lot of people, when I was working on the book, say, well, what's your alternative, you know? And I say to them, well, it's very, very, very important that we understand what we're talking about before we start talking about alternatives, or simultaneously we're talking about alternatives. So that's why I devote so much time to the negative part. But there are lots of very good organizations working right now to try to define systems of value, economic systems which will solve some of the problems that we face, that will make it possible for a sustainable system to operate. And I think it's not that mysterious. You know, we're obviously going to need a much greater appreciation of nature. We're going to need localization is going to have to replace globalization. We're going to need completely redesign corporations. And what we really need to see is a hybrid economic form, one that takes the good out of this one and the good out of that one and the good out of this one and tries to structure something that can solve the problem of an overpopulated world and an overconsumptive world, running out of resources world, a need for family and community and engagement and democracy. How to patch together a system like that? But even when we do that, and many people are trying to do that, you know, that's like there it is across the river. You know, how can we get there? You know, hey, the problem is getting from here to there, and that's the first problem that's got to be faced is while we're thinking of what a future system could look like and be like and how it would perform, and we can establish the values of it, which I go into fairly in depth in the last part of the book, we've also got to realize that the system itself is not going to let us go there right now. So we have to figure out political ways of reacting to the current system so that we can try to regain power, and that's really the tough go right now. But it'll be helpful for people to get a really good education on what the system, how it's structured, and what direction we need to go in. And that's why I did the book.
And I'm glad you did it. I mean, towards the end of the book, it'd be interesting perhaps to convene, if you have time, and with others, a conversation that takes on the end of your book, because I think that.
Yeah.
Whether you write about your pieces around on the issues around direct democracy and saving our democracy, or whether it's your Saral Sarkar and the whole question of where central planning fits in or doesn't, and especially your whole idea of redesigning corporations and what we learn from indigenous people, thing on the Iroquois.
That's very good.
Those things, they deserve a discussion on their own just to see how they fit together.
Absolutely. And, well, I agree. I'll invite you to it. We'll have such a meeting.
And we need that. I mean, I think that.
Yeah, well, that was sort of the point of that meeting that I talked about 3 years ago, you know, that sort of started this whole book process going. But it's probably a good time to reconvene it again.
Because I think people would wrestle with that all over the country. Because I think that people are looking for a way to think their way through this.
Right.
Which is one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the air with us to have this discussion, is because people are wrestling with this in America. Mm-hmm. And they really
are,
want to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So are you working on a second? Are you working on yet another kind of treatise?
Well, you know, I did work on a book. There's another book that got very little attention that we did 10 years ago. It's called Alternatives to Globalization,
Oh, yes. I never read it, but I do know the book, yes.
It's very good. It's great. It's great. It expresses in far greater detail than I do in this book what a new system ought to look like, what its ingredients ought to be. And I recommend, it's still in print, that book. People should get that, too, Alternatives to Globalization. I did it with a whole group of about 15 activists and economists, and we just basically laid out a lot of, you know, there's an idea in that book called subsidiarity, which I think is so important. I kicked myself for not including it in this book for some reason. I don't know what, I went unconscious there at the very end. But subsidiarity meaning that all power should vest in the system at the lowest possible level. In other words, you're going to need international agreements in order to solve climate change and in order to solve health issues or maybe international arms battles, that kind of thing. But most decisions ought to really be on the local level, local food, local production, local labor, local decisions about how the economy should function. And that concept is called subsidiarity. I mean, I talk about that in the book, but I don't use the term subsidiarity. It's a very, very good term. And there's many things in that book that are I highly recommend as well. That would be a very good companion for people to read. So in some ways, this book, that was the alternatives book, but that was a time when not enough people were talking about alternatives. They've started to talk about them now. And in this book, I wanted to deal with the point that not many people understand what the alternatives are focused on. You know?
Right,
so
exactly.
The language of the debate needs to be clarified. So that's what this book is about. So the two really do work together.
And let's name it. It's called Capitalism. And I just that there's a note here that my producer just sent. I want to tell you, who's of the young generation in their 20s, who wrote saying that your book you talked about, Alternatives to Economic Globalization, is one that he, as quote here in his note to me, turned a lot of people in my generation onto economics.
Good.
So that's...
Thank you.
I'll let you know that. Jerry Mander, The Capitalism Papers, wonderful book. I want to thank you for taking your time with us today.
I thank you very much for having me.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Justin Levy. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts, the WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.